sleeper, and now Raphar has helped to awaken you again. Chapter 7. On Tuesday morning, the sun was shining through the windows, and Mary was busy beating the daylights out of some bread dough. Hank found the name and number in the church records, the Reverend James Farrell. He had never met Farrell, and all he knew was the tasteless and malicious gossip going around about the man who had been his predecessor and had since moved far away from Ashton. It was a whim, a stab in the dark, Hank knew that. But he sat down on the couch, picked up the phone, and dialed the number. "Hello?" a tired older man's voice answered. "Hello," said Hank, trying to sound pleasant despite his tight nerves. "James Farrell?"
"Yes. Who is this?"
"This is Hank Bush, pastor of the..." He heard Farrell give a drawn-out, knowledgeable sigh. "Ashton Community Church. I guess you must know who I am."
"Yes, Pastor Bush. So, how are you?"
How do I answer that, Hank wondered.
Okay in some respects." "And not okay in other respects," Farrell offered, completing Hank's thought.
"Boy, you've really been keeping up on things."
"Well, not actively. I do hear from some of the members from time to time." Then he added quickly, "I'm glad you called. What can I do for you?"
Talk to me, I guess." Farrell answered,
"I'm sure there's a lot I could say to you. I do hear there's a congregational meeting this Friday. Is that true?"
"Yes, it is."
"A vote of confidence, I understand."
"That's right."
"Yes, I went through the same thing, you know. Brumell, Turner, Mayer and Stanley were in charge of that one, too."
"You gotta be kidding."
"Oh, it's strictly history repeating itself, Hank. Take it from me."
"They drummed you out?"
"They decided they didn't like what I was preaching and the direction of my ministry. So they stirred up the congregation against me and then managed to take it to a vote. I didn't lose by much, but I did lose."
"The same four guys?"
"The same four. But now, did I hear right? Did you really put Lou Stanley out of fellowship?"
"Well, yeah."
"Now that is something. I can't imagine Lou letting anyone do that to him."
"Well, the other three made that a pivotal issue. They haven't left me alone about it."
"And how is the congregation leaning?"
"I don't know. They could be pretty evenly divided."
"So, how are you standing up under all this?"
Hank could think of no better way to phrase it. He said, "I think I'm under attack. Direct spiritual attack." Silence at the other end. "Hello?"
"Oh, I'm here."
Farrell talked slowly, falteringly, as if thinking hard while trying to converse.
"What kind of spiritual attack?"
Hank stammered a bit. He could imagine how last night's experience would sound to a stranger. "Well, I just think Satan is really involved here." Farrell was almost demanding.
"Hank, what kind of spiritual attack?"
Hank began his account carefully, trying very hard to sound like a sane and responsible individual as he related the major points. The mania Brumell seemed to have for getting rid of him, the church division, the gossip, the angry church board, the slogan painted on his house, and then the spiritual wrestling match he had gone through last night. Farrell interrupted only to ask clarifying questions.
"I know it all sounds crazy," Hank concluded.
All Farrell could do was let out a deep sigh and mutter,
"Oh, blast it all."
"Well, like you say, it's just history repeating itself. No doubt you've encountered things like this, right? Or am I the one who has the real problem here?"
Farrell struggled with the words.
"I am glad you called. I always struggled with whether or not I should call you. I don't know if you're going to like hearing this, but...
Farrell paused for new strength, then said,
Hank, are you sure you belong there?
Uh-oh. Hank felt a defensiveness rising in him.
I do firmly believe in my heart that God has called me here, yes.
Do you know you were chosen as pastor by accident?
Well, some are saying that, but
it is true, Hank. You really should consider that. You see, the church ousted me. They had some other minister all picked out and ready to move in. Some guy who had a wide and liberal enough religious philosophy to suit them. Hank, I really don't know how you ended up with the job, but it was definitely some kind of organizational fluke. The one thing they did not want in there was another fundamentalist minister, not after they went to such great lengths to get rid of the one they had.
But they voted me in.
It was an accident. Brummell and the others were definitely not planning on it.
Well, that's obvious now.
Okay, good, you can see that. So, let me just get right down to some direct advice. Now, after Friday, this may all be moot anyway, but if I were you, I'd get packing and start looking for a position elsewhere, no matter how the vote comes out.
Hank deflated a little. This conversation was turning sour. He just couldn't buy it. All he could do was sigh into the phone. Farrell was forceful.
Hank, I've been there. I've been through it. I know what you're going through, and I know what you have yet to go through. Believe me, it isn't worth it. Let them have that church. Let them have the whole town. Just don't sacrifice yourself.
But I can't leave.
Yeah, right. You have a calling from God. Hank, so did I. I was ready to go into battle, to make a real stand in that town for God. You know, it cost me my home, my reputation, my health. It almost cost me my marriage. I left Ashton literally planning on changing my name. You have no idea who you're really dealing with. There are forces at work in that town.
What kind of forces?
Well, political, social, spiritual too, of course.
Oh, yeah, you never did answer my question. What about what happened to me last night? What do you think about that?
Farrell hesitated, then said,
Hank, I don't know why, but it's very difficult for me to talk about such things. All I can say to you is get out of that place while you can. Just drop it. The church doesn't want you there. The town doesn't want you there.
I can't leave. I told you that.
Farrell paused for a long time. Hank was almost afraid he had hung up. But then he said,
All right, Hank. I'll tell you. And you listen. What you went through last night, well, I think I may have had similar experiences. But I can assure you, whatever it was only the beginning.
Pastor Farrell, I'm not a pastor.
Call me Jim.
That's what the gospel is all about, fighting Satan, shining the light of the gospel into the darkness.
Hank, all the nice homilies you can dig up won't help you there. Now, I don't know how equipped or ready you are, but to be perfectly honest, if you come through it all with even your life, I'll be surprised. I'm serious.
Hank had no other answer he could give.
Jim, I'll let you know how it turns out. Maybe I'll win, maybe I won't come out alive. But God didn't tell me I'd come out alive. He just told me to stay and fight. You've made one thing clear to me. Satan does want this town. I can't let him have it.
Hank replaced the receiver and felt he would cry.
Lord God, he prayed, Lord God, what shall I do?
The Lord gave no immediate answer, and Hank sat there on the couch for several minutes trying to regather his strength and confidence. Mary was still busy in the kitchen. That was good. He couldn't talk to her right now. There were too many thoughts and feelings to be sorted out. Then a verse came to his mind. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Well, it sure beats sitting home just fussing and fuming and not really doing anything. So on went his sneakers, and out the door he went. Creone and Triscoll were outside waiting for their charge. Invisibly, they joined Hank, one on each side, and walked with him down Morgan Hill toward the center of town. Hank was not a man of great stature anyway, but between these two giants he looked even smaller. He did, however, appear very, very safe. Triscoll kept a wary eye open, saying, "What's he up to, anyway?" Creone knew Hank pretty well by now. "I don't think he even knows. The spirit is driving him. He's giving action to a burden in his heart."
"Oh, we'll have action, all right."
"Just don't be a threat. So far, it's the best way to survive in this town."
"So tell that to the little pastor here."
As Hank neared the main business district, he paused on a corner to look up and down the street, watching old cars, new cars, vans and four-by-fours, shoppers, walkers, joggers, and bicyclers stream in four and more directions, regarding the orders of the traffic light as mere suggestions.
So where was the evil? How could it be so vivid last night and a distant, dubious memory today?
No demons or devils lurked in the office windows or reached out of the storm drains. The people were the same simple, ordinary folks he had always seen, still ignoring him and passing by. Yes, this was the town he prayed for night and day with deep groanings of the heart because of a burden he couldn't explain, and now it was taxing his patience and settling him.
"Well, are you in trouble or aren't you?
Or don't you even care?" he said aloud. Nobody listened. No deep, sinister voices answered back with a threat. But the spirit of the Lord inside him wouldn't leave him alone. "Pray, Hank. Pray for these people. Don't let them escape your heart. The pain is there, the fear is there, the danger is there."
"So when do we win?" Hank answered the Lord. "Do you know how long I've been sweating and praying over this place? Just once I'd like to hear my little pebble make a splash. I'd like to see this dead dog twitch when I poke it."
It was amazing how well the demons could hide, even behind the doubts he sometimes felt about their very existence.
"I know you're out there," he said quietly, gazing carefully over the blankly staring faces of the buildings, the concrete, the brick, the glass, the trash.
The spirits were teasing him. They could descend on him in a moment, terrorize and choke him, and then vanish, slipping back into the hiding places behind the facade of the town, snickering, hide-and-seeking, watching him grope about it like a blind fool. He sat down on a sidewalk bench, feeling miffed.
"I'm here, Satan," he said. "I can't see you, and maybe you can move faster than I can, but I'm still here, and by the grace of God and the power of the Holy Spirit, I intend to be a thorn in your side until one of us has had enough."
Hank looked across the street at the impressive structure of the Ashton United Christian Church. Hank had known some terrific Christians who belonged to that denomination, but this particular bunch in Ashton were different, liberal, even bizarre. He had met Pastor Oliver Young a few times and could never get very close to him. Young seemed rather cold and aloof, and Hank could never figure out why. As Hank sat there watching a brown Buick pull into the church parking lot, Triscoll and Creone stood beside the bench, also watching the car come to a stop. Only the two of them could see the car's special passengers. Sitting on the roof were two big warriors, the Arabian and the African, Nathan and Armoth. No swords were visible. They were taking a passive, non-combatant posture according to Tal's orders, just like all the rest. Marshall had seen Bernice's film. He had seen the minute scratches from some kind of mishandling. He had seen the clumsy fingerprints at regular intervals that could very well have been placed there by a hand pulling the film out of the camera, unrolling it in the light. Marshall had gotten his appointment with Young for 1 o'clock. He pulled into the vast, blacktop parking lot at 12:45, still downing a deluxe cheeseburger and large coffee. Ashton United Christian was one of the large, stately-looking edifices around town, constructed in the traditional style with heavy stone, stained glass, towering lines, majestic steeple. The front door fit the motif. Large, solid, even a little intimidating, especially when you tried to heave it open all by yourself. The church was located near the center of town, and the carillon in the tower chimed each hour and gave a short concert of hymns at noon. It was a respected establishment. Young was a respected minister. The people who attended the church were respected members of the community. Marshall had often thought that respect and status just might be a prerequisite for membership. He engaged the big front door in a short Indian arm wrestle and finally got inside. No, this congregation had never spared the expense, that was for sure. The floors of the foyer, stairs, and sanctuary were covered with thick red carpeting. The woodwork was all deep furnished oak and walnut. On top of that was all the brass. Brass door handles, coat hooks, stairway railing, window latches. The windows, of course, were stained glass, and all the ceilings were lofty, with great hanging chandeliers and delicate scrollwork. Marshall entered the sanctuary through another ponderous door and walked down a long center aisle toward the front. This room was a cross between an opera house and a cavern. The platform was big, the pulpit was big, the choir loft was big. Of course, the choir was big, too. Pastor Young's big office, just to the side of the sanctuary, afforded a very visible access to the platform and pulpit, and Pastor Young's entrance through the big oak door each Sunday morning was a traditional part of the ceremonies. Marshall pushed that big door open and stepped into the reception office. The pretty secretary greeted him, but didn't know who he was. He told her. She checked the appointment book and verified it. Marshall checked the book, too, reading upside down again. The 2 o'clock hour was marked A. Brummel. "Well, Marshall," Young said with a cordial, businesslike smile and handshake. "Come in, come in." Marshall followed Young into his plush office. Young, a large-framed man in his 60s with a roundish face, wire-rimmed glasses, and thin, well-oiled hair, seemed to enjoy his position both in the church and in the community. His dark-paneled walls sported many plaques from community and charitable organizations. Along with those were several framed photographs of him posing with the governor, a few popular evangelists, some authors, and a senator. Behind his impressive desk, Young created a perfect picture of the successful professional. The high-backed leather chair became a throne, and his own reflection in the desktop made him all the more scenic and impressive, like a mountain reflected in an alpine lake. He motioned Marshall to a chair, and Marshall sat down, noticing that he sank to an eye level quite below Young's. He began to feel a familiar tinge of intimidation. This whole office seemed designed for it. "Nice office," he commented. "Thank you very much," said Young with a smile that shoved his cheeks into piles against his ears. He leaned back in his chair, his fingers interlaced and wiggling on the edge of his desk. "I enjoy it. I'm thankful for it, and I rather appreciate the warmth, the atmosphere of the place. Sets one at ease." "Sets you at ease," thought Marshall. "Yeah, yeah. So, how is the Clarion these days?" "Oh, pulling itself together." "Did you get today's?" "Yes, it was very good. Very neat, stylish. You brought some of that big city class here with you, I see." Marshall suddenly didn't feel too talkative. "I'm glad you're with us, Marshall.
We're looking forward to a very good relationship.
Well, yeah, thanks.
So, what's on your mind?
Marshall fidgeted just a little, then jumped to his feet. That chair made him feel too much like a microbe under a microscope. Next time I'll bring my own big desk, he thought. He walked around the office, trying to look casual.
We've got a lot to cover in an hour, he began.
We can always have more meetings.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, Sandy, that's my daughter, ran off last night. We haven't heard anything. We don't know where she is.
He gave Young a quick synopsis of the problem and its history, and Young listened intently with no interruptions.
So, Young finally asked, you think she's turned her back on your traditional values, and that disturbs you? Hey, I'm not a deeply religious person. You know what I mean. But some things have to be right, and some things have to be wrong. And I have trouble with Sandy just jumping over the fence from one to the other like she does.
Young rose majestically from his desk and walked toward Marshall with the air of an understanding father. He put his hand on Marshall's shoulder and said,
"Do you think she's happy, Marshall?" "I never see her happy, but that's probably because she's around me every time I see her."
"And that could be because you find it hard to understand the direction she's now choosing for her life. Obviously, you project a definite displeasure toward her philosophies."
"Yeah, and toward that professor lady who dumps all those philosophies on her. You ever met that, what's-her-name, Professor Langstrat out at the college?"
Young thought, then shook his head.
"I think Sandy's taken a couple of courses from her now, and every quarter I find my daughter more out of touch with reality."
Young chuckled a bit.
"Marshall, it sounds like she's just exploring, just trying to find out about the world, about the universe she lives in. Don't you remember growing up? So many things just weren't true until you could prove them yourself. That's probably the way it is right now with Sandy. She's a very bright girl. I'm sure she just needs to explore, to find herself."
"Well, whenever she finds out where she is, I hope she calls."
"Marshall, I'm sure she would feel much more free to call if she could find understanding hearts at home. It's not for us to determine what another person must do with himself or think about his place in the cosmos. Each person must find his own way, his own truth. If we're ever going to get along like any kind of civilized family on this earth, we're going to have to learn to respect the other man's right to his own views."
Marshall felt a flash of deja vu, as if a recording from Sandy's brain had been plugged into Young's. He couldn't help but ask,
"You sure you never met Professor Langstrat?"
"Quite sure,"
Young answered with a smile.
"How about Alf Brummel?"
"Who?"
"Alf Brummel, the police chief."
Marshall watched his face. Was he struggling for an answer? Young finally said,
"I may have met him on occasion. I was just trying to match the name with the face."
"Well, he thinks the way you do. Talks a lot about getting along and being peaceful. How he got to be a cop, I'll never know."
"But weren't we talking about Sandy?"
"Yeah, okay. Speak on."
Young spoke on.
"All the questions you're struggling with, the matters of right and wrong, or what truth is, or our different views of these issues, so many of these things are unknowable, save in the heart. We all feel the truth like a common heartbeat in each of us. Every human has the natural capacity for good, for love, for expecting and striving for the best interests of himself and his neighbor."
"I guess you weren't here for the festival."
Young chuckled.
"I'll admit, we humans can certainly misdirect our better inclinations."
"Say, did you make the festival, by the way?"
"Yes, some parts of it. Most of it was of little interest to me, I'm afraid."
"So you didn't drop by the carnival, eh?"
"Certainly not. It's a waste of money." "But about Sandy?"
"Yeah, we were talking about what's true and everyone's view. Like the whole subject of God, for example. She can't seem to find him. I'm just trying to pin him down. We can't agree on our religion, and so far you haven't helped much.
Young smiled thoughtfully. Marshall could feel a very lofty homily coming.
Your God, said Young, is where you find him, and to find him, we need only to open our eyes and realize that he is truly within all of us. We've never been without him at all, Marshall. It's just that we've been blinded by our ignorance, and that has kept us from the love, security, and meaning that we all desire. Jesus revealed our problem on the cross, remember? He said, Father, forgive them, for they know not. So, his example to us is to search for knowledge, wherever we may find it. That's what you're doing, and I'm convinced that's what Sandy's doing. The source of your problem is a narrow perspective, Marshall. You must be open-minded. You must search, and Sandy must search.
So, Marshall said thoughtfully, you're saying it's all a matter of how we look at things.
That would be a part of it, yes.
And if I might perceive something a certain way, that doesn't mean everybody's going to see it that way, right?
Yes, that's right.
Young seemed very pleased with his student.
So, let me see if I've got this right. If my reporter, Bernice Kruger, perceived that you, Brummel, and three other people were having some kind of little meeting behind the dart-throwing booth at the carnival, well, that was just her perception of reality.
Young smiled with an odd, what are you trying to pull, grin, and answered,
I suppose so, Marshall. I guess that would be a case in point. I was nowhere near the carnival, and I told you that. I abhor that kind of event.
You weren't there without Brummel?
No, not at all. So you see, Miss Kruger had quite an incorrect perception of someone else.
Of both of you, I suppose.
Young smiled and shrugged. Marshall pressed a little.
What do you suppose the odds are of that happening?
Young kept smiling, but his face got a little red.
Marshall, what do you wish me to do? Argue with you? Certainly you didn't come here for that sort of thing.
Marshall took a real stab at whatever it might catch.
She even took some pictures of you.
Young sighed and looked for a moment at the floor. Then he said coolly,
Then why don't you bring those photographs next time, and then we can discuss it?
The little smile on Young's face hit Marshall like spittle.
Okay, Marshall muttered, not dropping his eyes.
Marge will set another appointment for you.
Thanks a lot.
Marshall checked his watch, went to the door, and opened it.
Come on in, Alf.
Alf Brummel had been sitting in the reception area. At the sight of Marshall, he jumped awkwardly to his feet. He looked the way one might a split second before being hit by a train. Marshall grabbed Alf by the hand and shook that hand excitedly.
Hey, buddy, seeing as how the two of you don't seem to know each other very well, let me introduce you. Alf Brummel, this is Reverend Oliver Young. Reverend Young, Alf Brummel, Chief of Police.
Brummel didn't seem to appreciate Marshall's cordiality at all, but Young did. He stepped forward, grabbed Brummel's hand, shook it, and then pulled Brummel quickly into his office, saying over his shoulder,
Marge, make another appointment for Mr. Hogan.
But Mr. Hogan had left. Chapter 8 Sandy Hogan sat dismally at a small lunch table in a campus plaza shaded by an expansive grape arbor. She was staring at a slowly cooling microwave-packaged hamburger and a slowly warming half-pint carton of milk. She had made her classes that morning, but they had all slipped by her, mostly unabsorbed. Her mind was too much on herself, her family, and her belligerent father. Besides, it had been a horrible way to spend the night, walking clear across town and sitting all night in the Ashton bus depot, reading from her psychology textbook. After her last class of the day, she tried to take a nap out on the lawn in the sculpture garden, and had managed to doze for a short time. When she awoke, her world was no better, and she had only two impressions, hunger and loneliness. Now, sitting at this little table with a machine-vended lunch, her loneliness was stealing away her hunger, and she was on the brink of tears.
"Why, Daddy?"
she whispered in very soft tones, dabbling her straw in her carton of milk.
"Why can't you just love me for what I am?"
How could he have been so much against her when he hardly even knew her? How could he be so adamant against her thoughts and philosophies when he couldn't even understand them? They were living in two different worlds, and each disdained the others. Last night she and her father had not said a word to each other the whole evening, and Sandy had gone to bed depressed and angry. Even as she lay there listening to her folks turning out the lights, brushing their teeth, and turning in for the night, they seemed half a world away. She wanted to call them into her room and reach out to them, but she knew it wouldn't work. Daddy would make demands and place conditions on their relationship instead of loving her. Just loving her. She still didn't know what had terrified her in the pit of the night. All she could remember was waking up plagued by every fear she had ever known. Fear of dying, fear of failure, fear of loneliness. She had to get out of the house. She knew, even as she hastily dressed and ran out the door, that it was foolish and pointless, but the feelings were greater than any common sense she could muster. Now she felt very much like some poor animal shot into space with no means of returning, floating listlessly, waiting for nothing in particular and with nothing to look forward to.
"Oh, Daddy,"
she whimpered, and then she began to cry. She let her red hair fall down like soft blinds on either side of her face, and the tears dropped one by one to the tabletop. She could hear people passing, but they chose to live in their own world and left her alone in hers. She tried to cry softly, which was hard to do when her emotions wanted to rush out of her like the cascade from a broken dam. Came a soft and hesitant voice.
"Excuse me?"
Sandy looked up and saw a young man, blonde, slightly thin, with big brown eyes full of compassion. The young man said, "Please forgive me for intruding, but is there anything I can do to help?" It was dark in the living room of Professor Julian Langstrat's apartment, and very, very quiet. One candle on the coffee table cast a dull yellow light on the ceiling-high bookcases, the strange oriental masks, the neatly arranged furniture, and the faces of two people who sat opposite each other, the candle between them. One of the people was the professor, her head resting against the back of her chair, her eyes closed, her arms outstretched in front of her, her hands making gentle sweeping motions as if she were treading water. The man sitting opposite her was Brummell, also with eyes closed, but not mirroring Langstrat's expression and actions very well. He looked stiff and uncomfortable. At short intervals, and for a split second, he would crack his eyes open just enough to see what Langstrat was doing. Then she began to moan, and her face registered pain and displeasure. She opened her eyes and sat upright. Brummell looked back at her.
"You don't feel well today, do you?" she asked.
He shrugged and looked at the floor.
"I'm okay, just tired."
She shook her head, not satisfied with his answer.
"No, no, it's the energy I feel from you. You're very disturbed."
Brummell had no answer.
"Did you talk to Oliver today?"
she probed. He hesitated and finally said,
"Yeah, sure."
"And you went to talk to him about our relationship?"
That got a reaction.
"No, that's...
don't lie to me."
He wilted a little and let out a frustrated sigh.
"Yeah, sure, we talked about it. We talked about other things, too, though."
Langstrat probed him with her eyes, as if doing some kind of X-ray scan. Her hands opened and began to wave in the air just slightly. Brummell tried to sink out of sight into his chair.
"Hey, listen," he said shakily. "It's no big deal."
She began to speak as if reading off a note pinned on his chest.
"You're frightened. You feel cornered. You went to tell Oliver."
You also feel controlled.
She looked at his face.
Controlled? By whom?
I don't feel controlled.
She laughed a little to put him at ease.
Well, of course you do. I just read it.
Brummell looked for a split second toward the telephone on the end table.
Did Young call you?
She smiled with amusement.
There was no need to. Oliver is very close to the universal mind. I'm beginning to meld with his thoughts now.
Her expression hardened.
Alf, I really wish you were doing as well.
Brummell sighed again, hid his face behind his hands, then finally blurted,
Hey, listen, I can't tackle everything at once. There's just too much to learn.
She put her hand on his comfortingly.
Well, then, let's deal with these things one at a time.
Alf? He looked up at her.
You're frightened, aren't you? What are you frightened of?
You tell me.
And it was almost a dare.
I'm giving you a chance to speak first.
Well, then, I'm not frightened.
At least not until this very second, when Langstrat's eyes narrowed and began to bore into him.
You are indeed frightened,
she said sternly.
You are frightened because we were photographed the other night by that reporter from the Clarion. Isn't that right?
Brummell pointed his finger at her angrily.
See, now that's exactly one of the things Young and I talked about. He called you. He had to have called you.
She nodded unabashed.
Yes, of course he called me. He withholds nothing from me. None of us withholds truth from all the others. You know that.
Brummell knew he might as well open up.
I'm concerned about the plan. We're getting too big to hide anymore. We're risking exposure in too many places. I think we were careless to meet out in public like that.
But it's all been taken care of. There's nothing to worry about.
Oh, no? Hogan's on our scent. I suppose you know he was asking Oliver some very delicate questions.
Oliver can handle himself.
So, how do we handle Hogan?
The same way we handle anyone else. Are you aware that he talked to Oliver about problems he's having with his daughter? You should find that interesting.
What kind of problems?
She's run away from home. And yet she still had the desire to be in my class today. I like the sound of that.
So, how do we use it?
She smiled her cunning smile.
All in good time, Alf. We can't rush things.
Brummell got up and began to pace.
With Hogan, I'm not so sure. He may not be the pushover that Harmel was. Maybe having Kruger arrested was the wrong thing to do.
But you got access to the film. You had it destroyed.
He turned to face her.
And what did that get us? Before that, they weren't asking any questions. Now they are. Come on, I know what I'd think if I got my camera back and the film was ruined. Hogan and Kruger just aren't that gullible.
Langstrat spoke soothingly, putting her arms around him like the tendrils of a vine.
Ah, but they are vulnerable. First to you, and ultimately to me.
Just like everybody, he muttered.
He should have expected her reaction. She grew very cold and frightening and looked right into his eyes.
And that, she said, is another topic you discussed with Oliver today.
He tells you everything?
The masters would tell me, even if he didn't.
Brummell tried to turn his eyes away from her. He couldn't stand whatever it was that made such beauty so immensely hideous.
Look at me, she insisted, and Brummell obeyed. If you are not happy with our relationship, I can always have it terminated.
He looked down and stuttered a bit.
It's okay.
What?
I mean, I'm happy with our relationship.
Truly happy?
He felt desperate to appease her, to get her to let go of him.
I
I just don't want things to get out of control.
She gave him a slow vampirish kiss. You're the one who needs more control. Haven't I always taught you that?
She was cutting him to pieces, and he knew it. But she had him. He belonged to her. He still had a concern he couldn't shake.
But how many adversaries can we continue to remove? It seems like every time we get rid of one, bingo, another pops up in his place. Harmel went out, in came Hogan.
She completed the thought for him. You took care of Farrell, and in came Henry Bush.
It can't go on. The odds are against us.
Bush is as good as gone. Isn't there a confidence vote this Friday?
The congregation's getting good and upset, but...
Yes.
You know he removed Lou Stanley from the church for adultery.
Ah, yes. That should help the congregation decide.
A lot of them agreed with that move.
She backed away in order to gaze at him better, freezing his blood with her eyes.
Are you afraid of Henry Bush?
Listen, he still has a lot of support in the church, more than I thought he did.
You are afraid of him.
Somebody's on his side, I don't know who. And what if he finds out about the plan?
He will never find out anything.
If she had fangs, they would have been showing.
He will be destroyed as a minister long before then. You will see to that, won't you?
I'm working on it.
Do not bow to this Henry Bush. He bows to you, and you bow to me.
I'm working on it, I said.
She relaxed and smiled.
Next Tuesday, then. We'll celebrate Bush's Friday demise. You can tell me all about it.
What about Hogan?
Hogan is a limp and weakened fool. Don't worry about him. He's not your responsibility.
Before Brumell knew it, he was standing outside her back door. Langstrat watched him through her window until he drove off, taking the usual alley route where he would not be seen. She opened the drapes to let some light in, extinguished the candle on the coffee table, then took a folder from her desk drawer. Soon she had arranged in neat piles the life histories, personality profiles, and current photographs of Marshall, Kate, and Sandy Hogan. When her eyes fell on the photograph of Sandy, they glinted maliciously. Hovering invisibly over Langstrat's shoulder was a huge black hand adorned with jeweled rings and bracelets of gold. A deep and seductive voice spoke thoughts to her mind. Tuesday afternoon at the Clarion resembled a battlefield after everyone is either dead or retreated. The place was deathly quiet. George, the typesetter, usually took the day after publishing off to recover from the wild deadline race. Tom, the paste-up man, was out covering a local story. As for Edie, the secretary reporter ad girl, she had resigned and walked off the job last night. Marshall had not known that she once was happily married, but gradually became unhappily married and finally got a little thing going with a trucker that resulted in a very recent blow-up at home, with pieces of marriage flying everywhere and spouses fleeing abruptly in opposite directions. Now she was gone, and Marshall could feel the sudden void. Bernice and he sat alone in the glass-enclosed office at the back of the little newsroom ad room front office. From his second-hand $10 desk, Marshall could look through the glass and survey the three desks, two typewriters, two wastebaskets, two telephones, and one coffee maker. Everything looked cluttered and busy, with papers and copy lying everywhere, but absolutely nothing was happening.
"I don't suppose you know where everything is?" he asked Bernice.
Bernice was sitting up on the work table adjacent to Marshall's desk, her back against the wall, stirring a personalized mug of hot chocolate.
"Oh, we'll find it all," she answered. "I know where she kept the books, and I'm sure Rolodex has all the addresses and phone numbers."
"What about the cord to the coffee maker?"
"Why do you think I'm drinking hot chocolate?"
"Nuts. I wish somebody would have told me."
"I don't think anybody really knew." We'd better get an ad in for a new secretary this week. Edie carried more than her weight around here.
I guess it was a bad blow-up. She's leaving town for good before her husband's black eyes heal up and he can see to find her.
Affairs. Nothing good ever comes of them.
So, have you heard the latest about Alf Brummel?
Marshall looked up at her. She perched on the work table like some coy bird, trying to look more interested in her hot chocolate than in the spicy news. Under the circumstances, he said, I'm dying to hear it.
I had lunch with Sarah, his secretary, today. Guess he's gone for several hours every Tuesday afternoon and never says where. But Sarah knows. Guess our friend Alf has a special girlfriend.
Yeah, Julian Langstrat, psychology prof out at the college. That ruined it for Bernice.
How did you know?
The blonde woman you saw that night, remember? The day after one of my reporters gets busted for taking the wrong pictures at the carnival, Langstrat kicks me out of her class. Add to that Oliver Young's ears getting all red when he told me he didn't know her.
You're brilliant, Hogan.
Just a good guesser.
She and Brummel do have something going. He calls it therapy, but I think he enjoys it, if you get my drift.
So, what's Young's connection to either of them?
Bernice didn't hear his question. Too bad Brummel isn't already married. I could have done more with it.
Hey, reset your frequency, will you? We've got a little club here, and all three of these people are members.
Sorry.
What we're really after is whatever it is they don't want us to know. Especially if, and I mean if, it's worth trumping up a false arrest to cover up.
And destroying my film.
I wonder if any of those fingerprints on the film would tell us something.
Not much. They're not on file.
Marshall twisted in his chair to face her more directly. All right. Who do you know?
Bernice was smug. I have an uncle who's very close to Justin Parker's office.
The county prosecutor?
Sure. He does just about anything for me.
Hey, don't bring them into this. Not yet.
Bernice raised her hands as if he were pointing a gun at her and assured him, Not yet. Not yet.
But I'm not saying they won't come in handy.
Don't think I haven't thought of that.
So, tell me this. Did Brummel ever apologize?
After you bowed to him the way you did, are you kidding?
No official signed apology from him in his office?
Is that what he told you?
Marshall had to sneer. Ah, both Brummel and Young told me all kinds of things. How they hardly knew each other, how they were never anywhere near the carnival. Boy, I just wish we had those pictures.
Bernice was offended. Hey, you can believe me, Hogan. You really can.
Marshall looked into space for a second or two, musing. Brummel and Langstrat. Therapy. I guess that makes sense now.
Come on, let's get all the pieces out on the table.
What pieces? Marshall thought. How do you lay out vague feelings, strange experiences, vibes?
He finally said,
This Brummel and Langstrat, they're both into the same kind of thing. I can tell.
What kind of thing?
Marshall felt cornered. How about whammies?
Bernice looked puzzled. Oh, come on, Kruger, don't make me have to explain it. She said, You'll have to explain that to me.
Oh, boy, here we go, Marshall thought. Well, now it's going to sound crazy, but when I talk to each of them, and you ought to try it sometime, each of them had this weird, goony-eyed thing they did, kind of like they were hypnotizing me or something.
Bernice started to crack up.
Yeah, go ahead, laugh.
What are you saying? That they're all into some kind of Svengali trip?
I don't know how to label it yet, but yeah. Brummel's not nearly as good at it as Langstrat. He smiles too much. Young might be into it too, but he uses words. lots of words. Bernice studied his face for just the slightest moment and then said,
I think you need a good stiff drink. Would a hot chocolate do?
Sure. Get me one, please. Bernice returned with another personalized mug, Edie's, full of hot chocolate.
Hope it's strong enough, she said, and hopped back onto the table.
So, why do those three try to look unconnected? Marshall mused. And what about the other two unknowns, Pudgy and the Ghost? You've never seen them before?
Never. They could have been out-of-towners.
Marshall sighed.
That's a dead end.
Maybe not yet. Bramell does go to that little white church, Ashton Community, and I heard somebody just got kicked out of there for shacking up or something.
Bernice, that's gossip.
What would you say, then, to my talking to a friend on the Whitmore faculty who might be able to tell me something about this mysterious professor lady?
Marshall looked doubtful.
Please don't make any more problems for me. I have enough as it is.
Sandy?
Back to the really tough subjects.
We haven't heard a thing yet, but we're still calling around, checking with relatives and friends. We're sure she'll come home sooner or later.
Isn't she in Langstrat's class?
Marshall answered with some bitterness. She's been in several of Langstrat's classes. Then he paused.
Don't you think we might be blurring the line between unbiased journalism and personal vengeance?
Bernice shrugged. I'll only find out what's really there, and it'll be news or it won't be. In the meantime, I thought perhaps you'd appreciate a little background.
Marshall couldn't shake off the memory of his encounter with the fiery Julian Langstrat, and he hurt more deeply every time he recalled the professor's ideas coming at him through the mouth of his own daughter.
If it's a stone, turn it over, he said finally.
On my time or the Clarion's?
Just turn it over, he said, and started pounding his typewriter.
Chapter 9 That evening, Marshall and Kate sat three places at the dinner table. It was an act of faith, trusting that Sandy would be there just as she always had been. They had called everyone they knew, but no one had seen Sandy anywhere. The police hadn't turned up anything. They had called the college to check whether or not Sandy had been to her classes that day, but so far none of her professors or teaching assistants could be reached for a definite answer. Marshall sat at the table staring at Sandy's empty chair. Kate sat across from him, silent, waiting for the rice to steam.
Marshall, she said, don't torture yourself.
I blew it. I'm a washout.
Oh, stop it.
And the problem is, now that I know I blew it, there isn't much chance of a retake.
Kate reached across the table and took his hand.
There certainly is. She'll come back. She's old enough to be reasonable and take care of herself. I mean, just look at how much she took with her. She can't be planning on being gone indefinitely.
Just then the doorbell rang. They both jumped a little.
Yeah, said Marshall. Go ahead, be the mailman, or a Girl Scout selling cookies, or a Jehovah's Witness.
Well, Sandy wouldn't ring the doorbell anyway. Kate got up to answer the door, but Marshall hurried ahead of her. They both reached the door at about the same time, and Marshall opened it. Neither of them expected a young man, blonde and neat, college material. He carried no leaflets or religious propaganda and seemed shy.
Mr. Hogan? He asked.
Yeah, said Marshall. Who are you?
The young man was quiet but assertive enough to do business.
My name is Sean Ormsby. I'm a junior at Whitmore and a friend of your daughter Sandy.
Kate started to say, Well, please come in. But Marshall interrupted with,
Do you know where she is?
Sean paused and then answered carefully,
Yes, I do.
Well, said Marshall.
May I come in?
He asked politely. Kate nodded graciously, stepping aside and almost pushing Marshall aside.
"Yes, please do."
They showed him into the living room and let him have a seat. Kate held Marshall's hand just long enough to get him into a chair and silently remind him to control himself.
"Thank you very much for coming," Kate said. "We've been very concerned."
Marshall's voice was controlled as he said,
"What have you got?"
Sean was visibly uncomfortable.
I met her on campus yesterday."
"She went to school yesterday?"
Marshall blurted, startled.
"Let him talk, Marshall," Kate reminded him. "Well," said Sean, yes, she did. But I met her in Jones Plaza, an outdoor eating area. She was by herself and so visibly upset that, well, I just felt I had to get involved."
Marshall was sitting on pins and needles.
"What do you mean, visibly upset? Is she okay?"
Oh, yes, she's perfectly all right. That is, she hasn't come to any harm, but I'm here on her behalf."
This time both parents were listening without interrupting, so Sean continued.
"We talked for quite a while, and she told me her side of the story. She really does want to come home. I should tell you that first."
"But,"
Marshall prompted.
"Well, Mr. Hogan, that's the first thing I tried to persuade her to do. But if you can accept this, she feels afraid to come back, and I think a little ashamed."
"Because of me?"
Sean was walking on some very thin ice.
Are you able to accept that?"
Marshall was ready to be tough on himself.
"Yeah, I can accept that all right. I've been asking for it for years. I had it coming."
Sean looked relieved.
"Well, that's what I'm trying, in my own weak, limited way, to accomplish. I'm no professional. My major's geology. But I'd just like to see this family together again."
Kate said humbly, "We would, too."
"Yeah," said Marshall, we really want to work on it. Listen, Sean, you get to know me, and you realize I came out of a pretty bent mold, and I'm really tough to straighten out."
"No, you didn't," Kate protested.
Yeah, I did. But I'm learning all the time. I want to keep on learning."
He leaned forward in his chair.
"Say, I take it Sandy sent you here to see us."
Sean looked out the window.
"She's out in the car right now."
Kate was on her feet immediately. Marshall grabbed her hand and settled her back into her seat.
"Hey," he said, "who's being over-anxious now?"
He turned to Sean.
"How is she? Is she still afraid? Does she think I'm going to jump on her?"
Sean nodded meekly.
"Well," said Marshall, feeling emotions he didn't really want anyone to see. "Listen, tell her I won't jump on her. I won't yell, I won't accuse, I won't get sly or nasty, I just... well, I...
"He loves her," Kate said for him. "He really does." "Do you, sir?" Sean asked.
Marshall nodded.
"Tell me," said Sean. "Say it."
Marshall looked right in his eyes.
"I love her, Sean. She's my kid, my daughter. I love her, and I want her back."
Sean smiled and rose from his seat.
"I'll bring her in."
That evening, there were four place settings at the table. The Friday edition of the Clarion was on the streets, and the usual post-publication lull around the office gave Bernice the chance she needed to do some hoofing. She had been waiting eagerly for a chance to get over to Whitmore College to talk to some people. A few phone calls had landed her an important lunch appointment. The North Campus cafeteria was a new addition, a modern red brick structure with floor-to-ceiling blue-tinted windows and carefully kept flower gardens. One could eat inside at a small two- or four-person table or sit on the patio in the sunshine. The format was buffet, and the food wasn't bad. Bernice stepped onto the patio carrying a tray with coffee and a light salad. Alongside her was Ruth Williams, a cheerful middle-aged professor in economics carrying a taco salad. They chose a secluded table in the semi-shade. For the first half of their meal, they indulged in small talk and general catching up.